Hi, I'm Patrick Palm, and this is the Learn from Leaders podcast. In this show, I interview favorite customers and other interesting leaders in product development, marketing, HR, executive management, investors. You find favorite leaders in many different places and in organizations doing game development and publishing, software as a service and other tech companies and big enterprises, you know, going from very centralized command and control kind of organizations to a more modern way of working with a culture with high team autonomy and better alignment towards the company goals and values. So let's go.
John, I was just reading your book about big bet leadership. Since I built companies in the role as entrepreneur and I done some investments, any of those things always feels like a big bet. So I thought the title was really good, but what becomes very clear in your book and the experiences you draw from, this is something, you know, big and hard for big companies as well. So why did you write this book right now? Why did you feel like the timing was right for this book?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's fundamentally the most important question. And my co-author, Kevin McCaffrey, and I, what we recognize is that there's a lot written for contributors, middle management on how to innovate, how to, you know, make change happen. But there was very little written for an executive team, on what do they need to do differently. And what's apparent is two things. First is that this era of disruption isn't stopping or calming, it's actually accelerating. And secondly is that established companies, regardless of their size, established companies have a really difficult time in creating important and impactful change. A big bet is the big is the ambition. The bet is the fact that it there's calculated risk to it. There's unknown unknowns. There's risks. There's dependencies. There's all of these things. And that senior leadership needed a playbook in order to do this part of their job better because clearly we're not good at it. And that was really the market gap that we saw that we were trying to address for this book. And I'm sure that there's, you know, other ways to think about it, but, you know, that was our intention, was to create a playbook for senior management, regardless of company size, that would apply, you know, for a company or a team leader or a P&L leader, to actually, how do you create transformational change? Because the need is not getting smaller. The need is getting bigger and we're not good at it.
You said something there. You said, you know, we're clearly not good at it. Tell me more about that.
Well, I mean, if you look at any of the statistics of, you know, digital transformations, AI implementations, new market entry, product introductions, acquisitions, anything that kind of fits this mold of high ambition but has risk and calculated risks relative to it, all of the studies and statistics, you know, have something between a 70 to 90%, you know, failure rate. And that includes a lot of things that are pretty small in terms of ambition. But if you actually talk about things that have a high ambition factor to it, that quote unquote failure rate is pretty poor. And those are just the measures of where, you know, the errors of, you know, commission, where an action is taken, but it doesn't work out as planned. It doesn't measure the errors of omission, where, hey, we needed to make a change happen and we didn't do that. And so, you know, those are, you know, the statistics of this. And again, I would say that those are even understated, because those are basically kind of like on time, on budget types of statistics. But if you include hitting the ambition, the business case, the return for why we're going to take on a transformational journey, a transformational change, then I think it's single digit statistics in terms of those endeavors that actually deliver the pop, the benefit that we were hoping to achieve from it.
You have background at Amazon. Would you say that there's, you know, Amazon is generally very good at this, or is that a myth? And are the other companies that are, you know, worth studying, you know, when it comes to this?
Yeah. So I was an early leader at Amazon. I was responsible for launching and scaling the marketplace business. I was there from 2002 to 2006. And I learned so much, and that was early in Amazon's, you know, kind of timeline here. And we were just figuring out, like, oh, we're not a first party book and music retailer based in Seattle, Washington. We're a platform company, and a platform company that provides services both for internal clients and for external clients. And, you know, I had responsibility for kind of the first successful manifestation of kind of this platform mentality, which was the marketplace business. But, you know, now there's dozens of them within Amazon. And I do think that Amazon, while not perfect in so many ways, but they do have a very deliberate set of principles. So I wrote a book called The Amazon Way about their principles. They have a very specific mindset relative to operational excellence, and they have a very specific mindset relative to innovation and disruption and big bets. But the book is actually inspired from a few what we call big bet legends, and Jeff Bezos would be one of those. John Ledger, at the CEO at T-Mobile, was one of those. That's where Kevin McCaffrey and I worked together. Elon Musk and his companies, especially SpaceX and Tesla, is definitely an example of a leader that demonstrates these qualities. And then Satya Nadella at Microsoft, who's, you know, turned around the kind of the leading company of the PC era and turned them into the leading company of kind of, you know, the cloud and AI era. And, you know, what we took from those leaders are really the basis for this book. And then we kind of try to operationalize what we frame as kind of the three habits of big bet legends.
Well, I mean, it would be very hard for me not to ask when you put it like that. So what are the three habits?
Yeah. I left a dangling lead there for you. So, yeah. So the book is framed off of these three habits, which is relative to other really good operational leaders. What we think a transformational leader needs to focus on is first creating clarity. The second is maintaining velocity. And the third is accelerating risk and value, deferring out big commitments until you've tested key concepts out. And while those three habits sound simple, leaders fail at those all the time. And so kind of the playbook, it, again, is written for, you know, leaders to help them put those three habits into play. Much of it inspired from Amazon, but we've, you know, tested and pulled from other experiences and other inspirations to create this integrated playbook.
So can you break those three habits? If you would do the, you know, like the TLDR on each three of them, and maybe if you could just say something on,
you know,
why do leaders fail? Because, you know, you said that it's very common, you know, with failure here. So if you can just go break that down a little bit and like, where do leaders typically stumble?
Sure, sure. So I will do the short version on this because that could be, that is the book and everything. So create clarity. This is really the start of the journey. And what so many cases are stem from is not understanding the problem that we are solving, the problem for the customer, the operational problem, and a real intuition into the real job that your customer is trying to get done, so that you can formulate a hypothesis about what would the killer feature be to solve that problem. And so we call that formulation of both the problem and the hypothesis for the killer feature, we call that the big bet vector. And if you have that big bet vector in place, then you can use that across, you know, essentially the rest of the life cycle of testing and scaling out this concept. But in my experience, and I have lots of experience of being invited in to companies like, hey, come do a pressure test or a QA review for our digital transformation or for our big program. I will go and interview individually. I'll go interview, you know, 10 different leaders involved in it. And I'll basically ask them three questions, and I'll focus on the first two here. The first question is, what's the problem we're solving? And the second is, give me a clear definition of what the future state is. And in my experience, a third of the people I talk to, they won't even be able to answer the questions. Like, it becomes uncomfortable because they immediately recognize, oh my gosh, I don't understand what we're doing here. But the two-thirds who will answer the question, they don't come up with minor varieties of the problem and the future state. They come up with vastly different definitions of it. And that is what creating clarity is about. It's about really the cheapest experimentation we can do, which is, let's create clarity on the problem and the future state, and oftentimes variations of those things, right? Like, let's test this out, do thought experiments relative to those things. So that's the TLDR on creating clarity and what you want to end up with, which is this big bet vector, the problem, the future, the hypothesis for the future state. The maintain velocity, you know, we've all participated in programs, you know, or an annual plan, and everybody comes together and we go, we're committed. You're going to get priority attention. We'll do everything to make this happen. But what quickly happens is this program, this strategy, this endeavor, this journey just quickly evolves into the natural rhythm or state of how other programs run within an organization, and they slow down. And they slow down for a variety of reasons. They slow down because we have underpowered and partially allocated teams to the initiative. They slow down because we put the same environment and the same policies in place that prioritize, you know, kind of appropriate due diligence on them versus prioritizing for speed. And they slow down because, you know, we think that we have to reach both a precision of accuracy on some things, but then we actually think that we have to build something out completely in order to get to the end state. And so those are the reasons why, you know, we purposely call this habit maintain velocity. We always start off with good intentions and good velocity, but it's the maintaining it which is brutal. So we have a set of fairly predictable topics like, hey, if you're going to really be in this form, a transformation, high impact, but lots of risks and dependencies, you need to figure out ways to maintain the velocity of it. And then the third is, they accelerate risk and value. And this is really kind of the application of turning everything into an experiment and identifying the high value but somewhat ambiguous or unknown or assumptions that we're making relative to this future state, how do we isolate those and do a time-constrained test to understand that particular factor better? And what happens typically is a team falls in love with an idea. They've done the math and the business case on it, and senior leaders just go all in on it, right? Like they just go, we are committed to this, we are going forward, and they start announcing it like it's fact to the organization and oftentimes to investors and other stakeholders in the situation. And big bet legends understand the calculated risk nature, and they find ways to test those important things out early before they make big commitments. And what that allows them to do is it allows them to adjust or fail on an affordable basis. And it also allows them to survive this journey, because these things aren't oftentimes going to work out quite as planned. But because they're very specific in the wording and the approaches they take, everybody understands, oh, this is a set of experiments versus this is a committed plan. And if there's one thing that I've learned in working with really good operators is that while they say they understand innovation and they say they understand this journey, what their core belief system is that if I make a plan, that we should deliver to that plan. And that is not the way that big innovation, big transformation, big endeavors happen. And you have to help them build this other side of their brain. It's kind of the operating side of the brain versus the innovative part of the brain. And they have to really conceptualize kind of how to turn everything into an experiment and to bring the most important experiments forward, gain information on those before we make big commitments.
So the first one here is, the clarity, then we have the maintain velocity. I have so many follow-up questions on these, by the way. So we got clarity, we got maintain velocity, and what did you call the third one again?
Accelerate risk and value.
Accelerate risk and value. Okay, John, so with the third one there, with the whole, would you say that it's similar to, how a startup would, iterate towards, product market fit, maybe inspiration from, a book like The Innovator's Dilemma, or is this something a bit different in a larger environment? It would be cool to hear you, compare and contrast.
Yeah. So, everybody builds on the shoulders of others, right? And so, yes, we definitely, I think especially The Innovator's Dilemma frames the challenge so well of why established companies have a tough time disrupting themselves. But in our experience, like what we've seen with so many kind of agile organizations is a two key problems. The first is that agile is used as an excuse to have a low sense of urgency and a low accountability. It kind of becomes the methodology of no accountability, right? No fixed scope, no budget, no time frame. We're agile. And so we deeply believe in creating constraints and a set of urgency relative to these tests, right? Like that's about maintaining velocity, creating high accountability and a high sense of urgency there. But the more important factor is that this agile type approach, well, it's put in the context, it's given a mission that is fairly incremental in nature. And so what we try to bring is when you are running a true transformation, right? Like think about what that word transformation means. Transformation doesn't mean an incremental change or a slight improvement. It's about a fundamental rethinking of either a value proposition or of your operating model or of your cost model or all of those kind of put together, right? And so if you're truly trying to undergo a transformational journey, doing little tests of things isn't the important thing to do early. What's important to do is to do tests of the real outcome we are trying to get at, to that have true high risk and high value in clarifying. So an example would be, oftentimes, you know, Kevin and I were working on something at T-Mobile together, and the team would want to prioritize doing some type of UI concept or a tech stack concept. But the real risk was, can we get the customer acquisition cost at a target level that will fit the both the revenue model and the cost model for the business that we are trying to target? So the right type of test would really be a customer acquisition test and a value proposition test, not some type of technology test. And I think that's what happens so oftentimes, is that we view the risks as being a technology risk or an execution risk versus a real outcome risk. And so, you know, what we hopefully do is help people recognize early on, well, what are the real assumptions, risks, dependencies that have to be true in order to have this outcome that we want to create, and do the appropriate test as early as possible without having to build the whole solution stack before we go to market, and only then getting feedback as to whether our value proposition or our customer acquisition costs or our cost model is going to work out.
That sounds like one of the big challenges in the startup as well. You know, that, startup, you know, sometimes, you know, you kind of want to go and build the thing where maybe you actually don't have to do that.
It is. And so, you know, we wrote, what I know well is established companies, right? Enterprises. But this framework and mindset and techniques work for startups, and it works for teams and honestly individuals too. But we, the stories we tell and the examples that we give, and I think some of the context of the book is definitely, you know, fit for the world that we know very well, which is helping established companies create transformational change.
The first, you know, when you talked about clarity, you know, you have this term, you know, big bet, you know, vector. The thing I'm thinking about right now is you know, how big is a bet, so to say, you know, that something that to one person might seem like a really, you know, big thing might to someone else seem like a small thing. And how do you, well, let's put it this way. Do you see it as, you know, big bet can be relative to where you are and what you, you know, how you think. So you can really operate on different parts of your organization, or is it, I think what I'm curious about here is, how do you make this work, making sure that you actually do big bets enough so it doesn't become something that feels big, but it doesn't really affect your business? I'm just going to put something in there. Right. I remember that, there was some sections in the book I really liked when, you were describing, I think it was an example from Amazon where, you know, is this going to affect the bottom line in the beginning? No, but will it do it, you know, later when scaled? Well, yes. Yeah. I think you had more than one example of that I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's why you have to do the work up front, right? And that's why creating clarity is the first work to be done here. And so we leaned into that, you know, pretty hard in the book. And, you know, we combine kind of like getting at the real problem and hypothesis. We call this kind of the what sucks, like really get at the the real pain your customer or your operator is getting to the outcome. Like, well, what would be the superpower or the capability, the outcome that we would give them that would solve this real what sucks? And we think it's very important, especially when you're trying to get new customers or a big organization to do something different, to adopt something different, to switch to something, is it can't be just incrementally better. Like, it has to be demonstrably better on a number of different factors. And so really getting at that notion of like, what's the winning feature that we're going to have here, the lovable feature here. But then the third element has to be a business case and a cost model, a target cost model that is going to create advantage for you. And this is where oftentimes innovation programs at enterprises, one of the failure points, and I note just one of the failure points, but one of the failure points of innovation programs is they forget about how important cost model innovation is to sustaining an investment over a long period of time. And at the end of the day, if you have a cost model advantage relative to your competition, you can do things that your competition can't do. And so you have to marry these three concepts of truly understanding the customer, having deep empathy relative to them, having a perspective on like, what's the real capability, the outcome that would win them over, and then what's our target cost model? And then one of the things you need to do with this, we call it the outcome financial, or is the juice worth the squeeze analysis or memo, is that you have to recognize that that's built on assumptions, right? And dependencies. And you can't just leave it behind as a statement of fact, which is oftentimes what happens, is these things are just, hey, we did the analysis, we think this is going to be a great financial outcome. But you have to recognize it for what it is, which is it's a bunch of guesses and assumptions and targets that we need to hit. You need to recognize what those critical things are, and they tend to be around some type of unit cost measure, and figure out how do we test and validate those things early, as we talk about. So, you know, I already mentioned like an example where getting at the target customer acquisition cost, was the real high risk, high value assumption being made for a new go-to-market capability. And so we had to figure out various ways of testing and learning about that real early before we committed to a new business line.
You use the term wicked problem. And I guess it does not have to do with the recently, you know, Oscar-winning movie. What is a wicked problem? What was the difference between a wicked problem and just a problem?
Yeah. So a regular problem tends to be well understood by multiple people. So we all have some version understanding of the problem. It's easy to understand what the problem is. And one or two things tend to deliver the solution that we need, right? Like, oh, there's a data problem, or there's a scaling issue, a quality issue, or there's a technology problem. A wicked problem is different in that, A, depending upon your perspective, you can frame this problem in a variety of ways. And secondly, it takes all types of levers, from the design to the process to the technology to the incentive system to the network effect. Like, all, it takes all sorts of different levers in order to create a path in which you think you might gain this outcome that you want to approach. And so a wicked problem is one that doesn't like to be well defined, and oftentimes takes many different approaches and levers of change in order to truly solve the problem. That's a wicked problem.
You I want to go back to something you mentioned before. You when we talked about clarity, you mentioned, Jeff Bezos, but also a couple of other leaders. And I like reading biographies, and, they're so different. And would you, when I've been reading, I was reading, for example, the collective writings of Jeff Bezos, all those shareholder letters and other things. And I get the impression that, he seems to be very good at handling a lot of the things you talk about in the book by really, building an organization with the right kind of, ways of working in the organization. So it is like truly standing on the shoulder of giants there, right? Versus some other mentioned famous entrepreneurs are maybe more hands-on, so to say, and pride themselves of doing 18-hour workdays, and maybe Jeff is doing that as well. But I've been reading that he actually really values time with family in the morning, and he seems to have quite a pretty strict protocol for how he runs a day in a I would say maybe healthy way. Is that just how he wants to portray himself, or is there some truth in that? Well, and what's your impression of how these all amazing leaders are similar and different?
Yeah. So I would say Jeff's life now is very different than in the early 2000s, right? And so what he does, how he does it, what he prioritizes is very different. But how he thinks about both operational excellence, customer obsession, and how to innovate are very much the same. And so, I wrote a book called The Amazon Way, which is about the Amazon leadership principles. I wrote a book called Think Like Amazon, 50 and a half ideas to become a digital leader. Like, that's all the little tricks and levers that I learned at Amazon that I think are valuable for other companies. And those two books together are really, what I learned at Amazon and that I think that I've put into practice over the past 20 years and that I've seen be effective. And Big Bet Leadership is kind of builds on that, but takes a number of different learnings and the work that Kevin McCaffrey and I did at T-Mobile and some other places, and specifically focus on transformational change. And so, Bezos does so many things well. But one of them is how he communicates. And so, one of the things we talk about in Big Bet Leadership is the role that very good communication plays in creating a transformational success, and how it is oftentimes the root cause or one of the major root cause of a failing for a big bet. And so that's the problem, which is how to create actually valuable communication as well as to do it in a consistent manner. So, we have the recommendation of and the research behind it of you have to talk in stories. You have to actually identify the problem and the solution where you're going towards, and you have to do it time and time and time again. You have to become the chief repeating officer. And one of the things that I saw Bezos doing so well was he would keep us focused on that killer feature and getting to that as quickly as possible. So when we were launching the marketplace in 2002, he would stroll by, on one of those segways, and everything. And he wouldn't ask me hey, John, how are things going with the launch of the marketplace? He would ask me, hey, are third parties going to be able to register in the middle of the night and list an item and deliver an order? Because that was our version of what this killer feature was. We figured if we had that capability, then everything underneath it was going to fall in line. And so he would just force clarity on that. And he would also force don't let your organization structure get in the way of delivering that. Like John, you run a very small team here today, but you need to act like you can pull and demand accountability and attention from anybody across this organization in order to deliver this capability. And he made that super clear to me and to others, which is like, you know, transformation is messy. Organization structures are designed for operations. These transformations always go across the organization structure, and they oftentimes go across enterprises. You need to do a job of leading across those teams, and there's ways to do that. And one of those ways is to be the chief repeating officer and communicate very succinctly, not vague notions of the journey or the problem we need to solve, but very specific notions of the problem we are solving and the journey that we are on. And that is how you do the job of being a successful communicator for a major transformation.
So I have to ask you something about, you know, you call it the chief repeating officer, right?
Yep.
I was listening to one of those masterclass, and that was with Bob Iger, and he said something very similar. And I heard this in other places too. So if I just go to myself as a leader, I think, you know, the repeating part is incredibly hard and frustrating. You know, I don't like repeating things. I feel like if I emphasize something, you know, in a meeting where I know that, you know, there's one or several people that probably has now heard this, you know, more than twice, I feel embarrassed. What advice do you have to, you know, to leaders, both in startups like myself and in bigger organizations, to be good at, you know, being, you know, I also know quite a few politicians, and they are really good at this. You know, they have their talking points, and it's so consistent. But I personally find it to be very hard. Like when I'm on like my third iteration of it, I want to shoot myself. You know, what coaching would you give, you know, leaders to be good at this?
Well, first is just recognizing the challenge that people have and the, you know, literally thousands of messages that they're getting in a day and trying to process and remember and integrate into the priority and into the work that they're doing and into the decisions that they're making. So that's one, is just recognize how overburdened we are as people. Secondly, is that, you know, telling stories, if you want to be remembered, tell a story, right? Don't give a fact, don't give a figure, don't give a command, tell a story. Like, this is why this is important to our customer. And let me tell you about our customer, you know, Susan over here and what she was going through and everything. And that's why we need to do this change. Like, that story is, you know, there's been research done that says stories are 22 times more memorable than a simple fact or figure. But I also think that, you know, again, back to Amazon, like, you know, that's really the story of their principles. So there's now 16 principles of Amazon. I wrote the book about those principles called The Amazon Way. And what the design for those principles was really like, how do we avoid becoming a bureaucracy? How do we create the consistency of how we think, how we act, how we hold each other accountable, how we prioritize things, but do it in a framework that, you know, can evolve but is not fast changing, but helps avoid bringing everything to the center so that the leadership team has to decide on everything. Oh, well, we do that through a set of well-crafted principles. And so by thinking those through, by codifying them, by stating like, these are our principles, that's largely what Amazon has done through those principles, is codifying like, here's how Jeff Bezos and that early S team worked together what they thought was important, how they want everybody to be holding each other accountable, and how they want you to prioritize when we get into situations where you have to make choices and everything. And so I think it's very important for an organization to think through their authentic and meaningful principles that are tied to their mission and the challenges that they're experiencing that time, and codify them, meaning write them down, and then find ways to put them into practice. Principles should always have mechanisms to it, right? A principle is a concept. A mechanism is a tool that helps us put that that principle in practice. So, you know, for example, if you have a principle around customer obsession, how do you put that principle into practice? Oh, well, we have a voice of the customer program, or we have very specific metrics about customer experience that make it super clear when we are disappointing our customers, or, you know, other mechanisms like that. And so that, I think that's one of the things that Amazon got so right, was recognizing that slowing down, becoming a bureaucracy, was the problem they were going to experience, and that early on codifying these principles, it's just become the DNA of the organization.
I want to ask something different. You, in the book, you touch upon a false sense of precision. Do you recognize what I'm? That really resonated with me, because, you know, doing accurate estimates is something that, you know, our customers at Favorable, they have a lot of questions about, because they you know, they use our tool, you know, for the planning and collaboration, and then they want to get, you know, data out. Right. And, you know, there are good and there are bad methods of doing estimates. And some of them will definitely give you a false sense of precision, and then there are others that will give you a much higher accuracy. So that statement really resonated with me. But tell me more, you know, your thinking around it, and how this, you know, typically goes wrong.
When you're in a major change initiative, transformation within an organization, there's a couple of different enemies that you're trying to fight. One is, you know, kind of analysis paralysis, right? And so the thinking that more analysis will help us solve the problem or reduce risk even more. But you're also fighting like vague notions of clarity, right? And so on all of these analysis or recommendations we give, we're always giving both kind of a guideline as to how to create that clarity, but constraints in like, you need to do it at speed, it quickly. And one of those types of analysis paralysis traps that you fall into is thinking that you have precision in a recommendation, or oftentimes in a business case. And so this oftentimes falls in when you're doing that financial analysis and you believe that, you know, the target P&L or the target unit costs, that, you know, that you actually understand that, when actually what it's based upon is a set of assumptions and things that must be true in order to get to that target P&L or target unit cost. And so again, it kind of comes to recognizing, what is it that we understand really well versus what are the things that are important to delivering the business we want to deliver, but that actually should be tested out. Like, we're making an assumption or something needs to be solved for in order to deliver to this. But then not letting ourselves slow down with that, just capture that notion. Hey, this is an important assumption. It's an important factor. What we're going to do is we're going to put that into our testing backlog, right? Like we're going to have a set of these high value, but high risk assumptions, dependencies, things that must be true. And we're going to force ourselves to prioritize how do we go about testing those things to create as much clarity at speed up front in order to get a better understanding of this proposition, this transformation that we are proposing before, you know, to whatever the appropriate next stage is relative to that. And so that's kind of the notion of the mistake that people make, which is they actually think they have precision when actually what they have is an assumption or a guess.
And you also touch upon in the narrative, you know, memos. And I think we all have, you know, have heard about, you know, the Amazon way of, in not having PowerPoints, but instead having a memo and, you know, in the meeting, actually reading that memo in the beginning of the meeting. You kind of call out, you know, like the full stack of memos, but I have really two questions to this. Three questions. So one is it true that there's no PowerPoints and how do you, you know, if I'm in a situation in a leadership position and I want to start working this way, I guess I would probably get quite a bit of pushback from people who's used to using PowerPoints. You know, how do you transition?
That is a great topic, and I have a ton of experience on that. And really, like this book, as I mentioned, so Kevin McCaffrey ran new business incubation at T-Mobile here in the U.S. And so think of that as like new business concepts beyond the core business. T-Mobile is in the Seattle area. It's a company that doesn't want to become Amazon and everything, right? And so our mission was, how do we adapt the important things from Amazon and others to integrate into a different way of working and a different way of thinking that was going to be necessary to be successful in this mission that Kevin and I had? I got to be the senior innovation advisor for 3 years at T-Mobile helping out on this. And so, as you mentioned, Amazon deeply believes and practices this notion of, if something is complex and needs others to reflect upon it and to debate it and to agree, that is best done by writing it out. Sometimes it's just a long email. Sometimes it's a 6-pager document that Amazon's famous for. Sometimes it's a future press release. But in an organization that didn't have that background, how do you kind of bring them along? How do you be more specific and have a better toolkit to help them do that? So that's where we took this vague notion of like write a narrative, and we developed a set of very specific memos and templates and examples for how you need to do this in a team and an organization that didn't have all this background that Amazon has on it. And so that's what kind of where we came up with this memo stack of kind of the what sucks memo, the outcome definition memo, the outcome financial definition memo, and then the future press release, which is a kind of a specific thing from Amazon to help you think through these. But people over-index on the writing of those memos, and what they under-index on is it's about the debate. It's about the conversations that we have based off of those memos. That's where we get a group of people appropriately debating a topic and really experimenting on it, right? Like, well, is it like this or is it like that? Or I don't quite agree with that point. Is it more like this variation of that? And so if you can create kind of like a person drafting the perspective and then debating it and then updating that perspective, and depending upon where you're at, do we need to have another debate or do we have our final outcome on that? That is super, is just a killer habit to think through these hard, non-obvious situations, whether that's a transformation or not. Like that is a great working habit to develop, is writing out the situation, the problem, your proposal, if it's a important and complex situation. And so that's kind of the starting point. And the one appendix that we have in Big Bet Leadership is called Why Memos. And so it's kind of the research that's behind why writing things out and debating is a better way of working, especially in this interrupt-driven digital remote workplaces that we have. It helps people be happier. Writing things out actually helps you be happier. That's why journaling as a personal behavior has a sense of satisfaction to it, because it helps you process things. It allows you to share things so much better with others and to both get the best from them on their thinking, as well as to bring them along on your thinking. It helps you frame things in story format, right? As we've already talked about the importance of talking in stories. But there's all these features of why working in memos is different. And, you know, one of the things, and I get hired by teams. I've got a client right now that I'm thinking about right now that has me as an advisor to help them create this major operational transformation, but they're resisting the notion that, like, hey, we need to work differently when we're working on this transformation. We need to work differently. The inputs need to be different if we want different types of outputs. And it's a classic case of, like, everybody wants the outcome. Everybody wants the championship, the gold medal, but they're not willing to do the fundamental training and work differently on these topics in order to get the chance to have that championship outcome. And to me, it's like, you can't expect to get one without the other. The inputs lead to the outputs. And so we really focus on the inputs of what you need to do differently in order to get the outputs of the benefit of a major transformational upside.
I have been in situations where I deal with people that don't like, you know, the PowerPoint slides. And one, you know, solution to that, for a lot of good reasons, is what you called out here. You know, the memos, you know, you mentioned the appendix with some research behind it. But I'm thinking about a few organizations that are very, you know, product oriented, I dealt with. They were going in the direction of basically images. You know, they wanted to communicate.
Yep.
They basically prohibited text for, like, you know, you need, and the only text that was, you know, maybe allowed was like the question. But they really tried to steer everything towards the image. And the downside of that, I guess, is that it's a little bit hard if, you know, you need to put some context to it and, you know, kind of like frame it with some words, you know, verbally for it to make sense. But the good thing, from what I experienced with these guys, was that it definitely created that conversation that you're referring to. You know, you're instantly in debate.
Right.
How do you feel about, like, you know, videos and maybe... I mean, today when everything is videos, you know, should maybe the story sometimes be expressed as a clip, like almost like a social media reel, and images, and, you know, those mediums. Can you see that also fitting into this?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, prototypes and visualization can be an important way of communicating what the future is that you're trying to point out. But you have to be very clear on, like, what's the mission that we're trying to do. If it's just to get approval for kind of the look and feel or the branding experience on something, well, then, you know, a prototype is the way to do that and everything, right? Or a visualization of it. But if that is just the above the waterline piece of the iceberg of, like, hey, we're going to solve a problem, and here's the visualization, the manifestation of, like, what the UI or what the experience might look like. But the iceberg that's underneath the waterline, well, that's the real work that has to be done. And those are the real problems, and that's where the risks are. Well, then your prototype just tees up the conversation. It doesn't capture the essence of all that stuff that's below the waterline, right? Which 90% of the iceberg is below the waterline here, right? And so that's where you need to complement the prototype with like, well, let's talk about the iceberg that's underneath the water here and our theory of what the problem is and how we're going to solve for that part of the problem here. And so that's where a memo is often complements kind of a powerful prototype.
I want to jump to something different. You know, the second one after clarity was, you know, maintaining velocity. You do address in the book a bit about, you know, teams being organized, independency. Let's see, what is it you call it now again? You call it the big bet dedicated team, or what's the term you use for it?
Yeah, so we talk about a dedicated team as kind of being the most controllable factor that you have in kind of the success of a team, but in particular, the leader of that team. And so in the book, we call it a DRI, which is a directly responsible individual, which is a term that's used by lots of companies. Amazon has their version of that called a single-threaded leader. And what oftentimes happens in these organizations is A, they don't have dedicated, small, dedicated kind of full stack teams, right? Strategists, designers, builders, you know, the right business people involved. They don't have a dedicated team. And the leadership of that team is underpowered, right? Like it's essentially a project manager or a product manager there. Well, that person doesn't have the sway. They don't have the perspective. They don't have the ear. They don't know how to navigate relative to both internally the organization, but externally too and everything. And so you need to really power the team with an appropriate senior enough leader who's going to be able to, you know, kind of get this thing moving at pace, and then give the right constraints and the right policies and the right leeway to help that leader like maintain that velocity that we're talking about. And so that's why, you know, it's not one simple thing to be done. It's like, oh, not just that we need a dedicated team. Oh, and it's not just that we need a directly responsible individual that's senior enough. Well, they need to have the right, you know, kind of policies in place that let them do the job of testing out these concepts at speed. And so it's always a combination of factors that you need. But yes, I mentioned early on that I get brought in to do a lot of, you know, kind of pressure tests or QA reviews of transformations. And I said, I essentially asked three questions. And I said, the first one was, what's the problem? The second one is like, well, what's the future? But the third one I didn't mention. Well, the third one is always like, talk to me about the team, how dedicated they are, and show me how senior is the full-time dedicated leader of this person. And if you tell me about the team and how senior the full-time or nearly full-time leader of this team is, that is such a controllable and predictable factor as to whether this is actually going to be a successful endeavor.
So the leader of that team you mentioned, should that person also be fully dedicated to the team, or is that someone who can, because I guess, you know, the more senior that person is and, you know, having that, yep, you know, clout that you refer to, I guess it's going to be harder to motivate that person being singularly dedicated to this team.
And that's one of the things that a company like Amazon, they're willing to take a senior person and go, you are full-time dedicated on this, what is to now a very small idea, right? So, you know, I remember when they were starting the Kindle team, they took an SVP and it's like, hey, Steve, like, you know, you now have a team of one and it's you, and your job is to create this Kindle product and ecosystem and business and from scratch. Like, Steve built that organization and everything. Like, they are willing to make bold moves on something like that. And so No, the senior person doesn't have to be full-time dedicated. And oftentimes it's kind of a portfolio of concepts that that senior person is working through. That was Kevin McCaffrey's job at T-Mobile. And so it can be done without a dedicated person. But I'm telling you, if their incentive system and their goals aren't aligned to the success of approaching this big bet in the right way, like you are playing right into the game of the innovator's dilemma, and you know, just continuing to do more of the same versus an actual reinvention or new concept. And to some degree, Patrick, like that's why a big bet, like it has to be worth it, because otherwise it's just going to be an incremental project, run it with an incremental project manager and everything. That's great. That's not a big bet. Those things are good. Those things are necessary. But if what you need is a true re-envisioning of your value proposition for your product or your service, and or a reinvention of your operating model, and or like a cost model reinvention or some other type of high ambition, high risk endeavor, don't underpower it. Underpowering it is, again, probably the most controllable factor we have in whether it's going to be successful or not.
So I think this is super interesting. And I would like to hear your view on how to fix a problem. First I want to see if you agree with this problem. So now when there's been...
So we're going to do on the fly application here. I love it.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Right. You're putting me in the hot seat now.
Yeah. So one of the, I'm going to take an example that I'm very familiar with. I've been doing a lot of work in the game development industry the last 20 years. And mostly on the side of, you know, the what's called production there, which is, you know, the organizational work. And you know, the stuff that you were just talking about fits so well here. So one of the really, I've been doing several interviews on this podcast where we talk about, you know, why is the game industry having so much challenges right now, even though the industry is on a meta level so successful. You know, it's bigger than movies, it's bigger than music. You know, it's kind of like, you know, as an art form, you know, we won, you know? But at the same time, you know, there's a lot of problems right now where it can be very easily summarized that, you know, one of the key reasons why there's so much issue in the industry is that people are basically spending more dollars on playing the same games as before. So, you know, basically, you know, spending more money on Fortnite or Call of Duty instead of playing, you know, new exciting games. So there's a fundamental problem in the industry, which is, you know, making investors nervous, making the big publishers not making, you know, basically big bets. And then, you know, when we break down this conversation in a, you know, when I'm talking online, like, you know, you and I are doing right now with an industry, you know, veteran, sometimes we will raise the point that, well, actually maybe we're just not innovative enough. You know, we're not making big bets on, you know, with the games we're making. You know, we're kind of playing it safe, basically. And one of the things that I see very clearly coming from the production side is that when companies are nervous, they tend to be very focused on what they think is efficiency. So what we just talked about, where I would say a big bet is needed. You know, you need to do experimentation. You really need to find that, you know, new fun, you know, in the game. Instead, it will, you know, people will be super overallocated across teams. You know, if you would have a specific, you know, programmer or artist, and that person is 100% in a team that will be the equivalent of a big bet team here. And it doesn't seem like that person is, you know, 100% allocated time wise all the time. Someone would definitely come in and say, okay, we cannot work in this way. We need to allocate this person to four teams so we maximize, you know, that resource. And this is where we get into, you know, just the word resource instead of saying person, I think is a pretty strong signal of the problem here. So we have a really good example here, I think, of what you're talking about, where I think it's fear that drives this, you know, over allocation of people that kind of kills all the new stuff. So first, I guess you have seen the same thing in other industries. And if yes, how to counter that? Is it mid-management which is the problem, and you need to kind of explain this to senior management that can actually push this through, or how to actually, you know, break this kind of vicious cycle?
Yeah. So I'm not a gamer or from the game industry, so I am truly just triangulating here to an analogy. But, you know, my guess would be, like, you've got some big incumbents with fans, right? And so, like, they have a ton of advantages. And so from a macro challenge, it's like, how do we create a brand and an experience that provides something different, either different to the existing fan or different to create new fans, right? And so I think of, like, the retail experience and what brands have had to do to compete in a brutal retail environment. And a lot of it is around not just what you are buying, but the experience both of buying it and using it and servicing it and end of lifing it, right? And so my natural orientation on the macro challenge of how to win when you've got these formidable brands out there is like, you got to figure out a way to do something different to either win the existing fans or to create a new set of fans that extends the game beyond kind of the traditional model of what we think the game is, right? So again, I'm probably wrong on this, but I am purely intuiting what the situation is. And then
I think just to before I continue, I would say that probably most, you know, the senior, you know, leaders in the industry, in the games industry I'm speaking with would probably agree with that. And now they're like, okay, so how do we make sure that the big players, you know, the executives at the big players actually recognize that problem and actually do something, which is not to fall back into the old.
And just don't do the same thing again, you know, and everything, right? Like not just make the same mistake again. And I think the other part of this is, you know, I'll tell the story from Amazon is like, it's like guided wandering. Like you can't exactly create the timetable or the exact recipe it's going to take to have a winner. And that's why if you can have the luxury of some time, like that's the greatest asset we can have, and why you want to start early on these concepts so that you can have time, right? And so the story from Amazon is, you know, we launched the marketplace business in 2002. The stock was $5. Everyone was pressuring us. Bezos had, you know, nerves of steel to say, hey, because this was actually the third attempt at a third party selling approach. And everyone was telling them, you can't do it again. And eBay was kicking our ass. And he said, no, we're doing it again. But it really took 7 years and the combination of two other big bets that weren't even on our board when we launched the marketplace business. Those two other big bets were Amazon Prime, and the third one was something called FBA, or Fulfillment by Amazon. And it took the combination of those three capabilities and patience to let customers learn, oh, I can come to Amazon for more than just books, music, video, and first party inventory. I can, in a very safe, seamless, highly trusted manner, purchase from third parties at Amazon in categories way beyond books, music, video. That took like 7 years to develop, right? And so this journey is not going to be a predictable journey. And again, back to operator mindset, everybody likes predictable journeys, but you oftentimes have to understand, like, you know, it this is not an 18-month proof of concept here and everything, right? And you have to be able, and that's why you have to have cost model innovation, because these big bets, if you can create where they're unit cost profitable from the get-go and have a cost model advantage to them, you can afford to be a whole lot more patient and to pump more into the marketing and development or whatever it is, promotions that it takes to build this new brand, this new capability with your customers. And so, you know, that's the playbook that this takes. And that's why we wrote this book for senior leaders, because only senior leaders can make those types of decisions and create that environment that doesn't suffer from just short-termism and incrementalism. If everything is going to have be a short ROI and everything, well, all you're going to do is incremental little things. Reinventions take some time and they're hard to predict.
So you said that's a great story, you know, with the 7 years there. In the book, you talk about being good at managing kind of, you know, continue, kill, or pivot, you know, the big bet.
Yep.
Is this an example of where it was really
yes.
continue or is it an example of pivot or maybe both?
No, it was more of an example of continue. And so that chapter, continue, kill, pivot, or confusion, is about those high stake moments that happen where you have a very specific job to be done as a senior leader, which is decide, like, what are we doing with this endeavor, this journey, this investment going forward? And there's all types of mistakes that happen in these types of situations, all types of biases and kind of forces at play. And so we outline a recipe of like how to do these things well so that you make the best decision possible and move forward versus ending up with what oftentimes happens, which is confusion or falling back to comfortable habits. And so that's why these types of moments are different. You have to recognize them. You have to have a different playbook on how you run moments like that. We'll call them at a meeting, right? How you run that type of meeting has to have a different hygiene and a different set of inputs and how you run the meeting and the outputs you do to it, and why we thought it was important to call out as a specific chapter in our book.
I have a final question to ask you here. Do you, and if we look a bit into the future, in the startup world, you know, there's this conversation around who will be the first to create like a one person billion-dollar company. So, you know, the one person who's using a ton of, you know, various AI tools to just get a lot of stuff done and actually build a company to $1 billion of value. I mean, someone is going to be the first, but I think the more interesting question is maybe not who's exactly the first person, but rather, do you think we are looking at organizations being radically smaller, you know, doing big things? And do you think that maybe this is a key to actually be more successful with this? Because in a way, and you know, maybe I'm wrong about this, but to me it seems like it's easier to get these kind of things right if you are fewer people you need to coordinate than more people.
I absolutely agree with kind of the prediction as well as why there's advantages of thinking in this way. So the title of the book is Big Bet Leadership. The subtitle of the book is Your Transformation Playbook for Winning in the Hyper-Digital Era. And so we start off with what's the hyper-digital era? And what we end up with is a prediction that, you know, is effectively what you've seen over the past 25, 30 years of kind of the digital era is like, man, we've really improved the customer experience and value propositions and new business models. But if you look at back office, mid office productivity in mid to large companies, it's really been a very slow increase in productivity. And that's what I think is going to be different about this coming age. That's the hyper digital era, which is you are going to have 10 to 100x degrees of productivity with companies that are specifically designed or redesigned to take advantage of AI and other approaches to create productivity that is vastly different from today. And that may sound like a great thing. It may sound like a bad thing, but it kind of doesn't matter. I think it's coming and everything. And so that concept of kind of hyper productivity is really what the essence of like this one person $1 billion company is kind of recognizing, which is you are going to have operating models and cost model innovation that creates very different productivity levels. And companies need to decide, am I going to participate in this or not? And the prediction is like those that choose to not do it are going to suffer the consequences over a period of time, not tomorrow, but over a period of time. And that those who do want to participate in it, my recommendation is do it early. I wrap up the book with one final recommendation, which is to be an active skeptic. Active meaning like you engage, you start running experiments, you start running the big bet leadership playbook, but be a skeptic. Prove things out before you commit to them. And I think that is the path of success through this disruptive period that is here and is going to get more disruptive, is to be an active skeptic.
I hope you liked that interview. If you did, you know what to do. Share it on your favorite social media so others can learn from the Favor community.